This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
Just a perfect day. Drink sangria in the park.
My name is George. I first saw Lou Reed in the Velvet Underground in 1975. It was the second date with my wife. We just celebrated our 34th anniversary. She's devastated. The world is going to miss Lou Reed. No, I will.
Missing Lou Reed, the legend, the artist, the pop culture commentator whose lyrics were as likely to end up in the New York Times or on the walls of a gallery or painted on a graffiti wall in Lower Manhattan as on a record.
Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you.
Remembering Lou Reed, who died yesterday, let us know what you think of as a perfect day, remembering the music of Reed and the Velvet Underground. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or be a part of the conversation by posting a comment at thetakeaway.org. But first, we begin in the Middle East, where there is some good news. 3 days ahead of its deadline, the Syrian regime submitted a formal declaration of its chemical weapons arsenal and its plans for destroying that stockpile. Now, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the international watchdog tasked with destroying the chemical weapons, will review Syria's submission and plan for complete destruction by mid-November. Joining us now is Robin Wright, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Robin, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Happy Monday, John.
Yes, indeed. And let's talk about this meeting the deadline issue. Is this a little bit of international NGO theater, or are the Syrians really demonstrating once again their seriousness?
Well, there's still serious questions to be answered. The United States estimated a few weeks ago that Syria had 45 different sites where chemical weapons were deposited, and Syria has now disclosed 23 of those sites. So there's some questions about the gap, questions about did they consolidate some of their weaponry in some places. There are still some sites that have not yet been visited by the international group that is trying to dismantle these weapons. And there's still enormous questions about can the world meet the deadline to destroy all of them, which is about a year from now.
Deadlines aside, is there a growing consensus that at least the Syrians, if not the international community, have control over these weapons?
Certainly there is a process in place now that gives greater reassurance that Syria will not again use chemical weapons, and that it has at least in principle agreed to give them all up. And that's really a very important development. The tragedy for Syrians, however, is that 95, maybe even more, percent of the people who've died in this civil war have died because of conventional weaponry, not chemical weaponry. And so there are still enormous issues to be addressed when it comes to this conflict.
Two takeaways, then. Does the diplomatic momentum that was focused so much on the chemical weapons, do you think that could deliver any benefit to actually getting a settlement in this war? And secondly, is the agreement that worked or seems to be working in Syria replicatable to other places where weapons of mass destruction are a problem?
Well, on the diplomacy question, there's clearly a hope that the momentum created by the coming together, particularly of the United States and Russia, will generate movement toward a peace conference, bringing together the opposition as well as the regime to talk about a future. The problem is that the opposition has not yet agreed to go to talks. There is a tentative date of November 23rd in Geneva that has been announced by some of the Syrians, not by either the United Nations or the individual countries involved in organizing it. So there's still a lot of questions. But the big problem is that the opposition is now so divided. There are something like 1,000 different militia groups. There is the exiled Syrian National Coalition that's an umbrella group for a lot of different factions, some of which have said they won't go. Some of the militias have said they won't go. They won't agree to anything unless President Assad will step down. So it's not just a process of getting by everyone in the room. It's getting everyone in the room to talk about the same thing to ensure that it doesn't just fail automatically. But on your broader point, yes, it is a good signal that this chemical weapons agreement was signed onto by the Syrians and that there is new progress. The Syrians are meeting a deadline and that it could be a precedent for cases elsewhere in the world.
Robin Wright, distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Robin, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
You know, a long time ago in a dusty, messed up radio studio downtown here in New York, when I had a show late at night, we were talking about songwriter Doc Pomus, a rock music genius who died of cancer, and Lou Reed of the Velvet Underground, and legend in his own right, came over and talked to us on the radio. I don't remember what he said. I just remember his face. Serious, mysterious. So much behind it. A man seemingly humbled by life and death at the same time.
I was interested in some kind of magic, some transcendence, something that would take one away from everything. And I wrote Magic and Loss because there had been loss to temper any magic. And there didn't seem to be anything I knew of that helped you with this particular subject matter. And I just wrote it. I didn't have any choice about it. That's what I wrote. And that's all I could do at the time.
I see the sword of Damocles is right above your head. They're trying a new treatment to get you out of bed.
That's Lou Reed singing about the Sword of Damocles there from a PBS documentary, American Masters. We're remembering the magic of Doc Pomus. He was then one of the many people that Lou Reed said goodbye to as he outlived people like Andy Warhol and the musicians and artists of the renegade rock and art scene in New York in the 1960s. CJ, Lou Reed died over the weekend at age 71. He'd had a liver transplant earlier this year and had health challenges. Reed and his wife, Laurie Anderson, were New York fixtures, disciples of the force of music, of art, and culture altogether and its power to comment on our world. Transformer, Rock and Roll Animal, so many albums, words and lyrics, songs and scenes, it's hard to imagine him gone. Earlier today, we spoke with Mo Tucker, the drummer from the Velvet Underground, and she says it was all just music back in the day.
I always thought our music was stunning, but I wasn't thinking of it being artistic or groundbreaking, but I was having fun and really loved our music. I loved it, loved playing it.
What were the audiences like back then in the days when the Velvet Underground was really underground?
Well, there were a few shows, but one in particular, this when we first were playing with Andy. We played at the YMHA in Philadelphia, and people left in droves because it was, you know, it was older people who didn't were expecting, I guess, Andy to be showing his paintings or something, and what they got was us. So that was one side of it when we'd play places like that. But when we'd play, like, in Boston, the audiences, well, many were drugged, I'm sure, but lots of dancing and lots of standing around looking and seemingly very appreciative.
What was the connection between the Velvet Underground and Andy Warhol and that whole art scene?
Well, there was more of a connection between Lou and John, probably, and Andy. Now, I considered Andy as a friend, but I wasn't involved in being philosophized or anything. But the main connection was our collaboration, doing our multimedia, as they called it, shows.
I mean, it really was revolutionary. We think of it now as music videos or,
yeah,
you know, stage shows. But back then, I mean, you were inventing the world.
It was, yeah, way more revolutionary than I thought at the time. It just didn't, you know, even when you're doing a project on your own, you don't think of the effects or the possible effects or anything. But it was really revolutionary. Must have been quite a shock to lots of audiences.
What are the lyrics that stand out in your mind of Lou's songs? I mean, he particularly valued his poetry, his sense of the use of words.
Yeah. The lyrics to Heroin, Waiting for My Man, Pale Blue Eyes. Those are some of my favorites. All Tomorrow's Parties, I always liked the lyrics to that.
Where did he come up with this stuff? Where did he get it? Did you wonder if there was like some magic fountain?
Well, in a way, Lou was very well read and obviously very intelligent and admired a lot poets and the use of words. I find it very, in a way, admirable of people who can write songs that don't mean anything to them personally. In a way, I find that very admirable. Lou didn't do that, but I think every song Lou ever wrote had something personal in it, with it. And he could, you know, he could certainly write a song that didn't mean anything to him. But the few songs that I've written, every one of them has a totally personal meaning to it. I am unable to write a song that doesn't mean something to me. Not because I'm some great poet or internalist, but I think that's a talent to be able to do that. And then there's the talent of Lou, of someone like Lou, to be able to write songs that are very meaningful to himself and apparently to lots of other people.
His material wasn't what was going on in his life. His material was the whole world.
Yeah, yes, that's true. But also, I think initially, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that initially most of the songs were about something personal to him. Later on, he took on more worldly topics, which, were, you know, if you're going to take on a worldly topic in a poem or a song, it also means that that topic means something to you if you're writing about war or politics or whatever. If you don't care about it, you wouldn't, or he wouldn't for sure write about it.
And he loved the fact that people couldn't figure him out, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. It's nice to be a mystery.
And he's a mystery today.
Yeah.
You know that song, that whole idea about a perfect day?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're asking people what their perfect day is, their idea of a perfect day. Do you have a thought on that?
Every day you get through, I guess, is a perfect day. Today and yesterday aren't too perfect, though.
No.
I feel very weird, very off kilter.
Well, Mo Tucker, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Mo Tucker is the drummer for the Velvet Underground. Also from the Velvet Underground, John Cale on Facebook yesterday, lost my schoolyard buddy. David Bowie wrote, he was a master, and Whoopi Goldberg, Lou is one of a kind, and this colored girl still says, deet diddy, deet diddy, diddy, deet.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Our human ability to manipulate and observe the electronic universe is beginning to be matched by a growing human ability to do the same thing in the biological universe. In the 21st century, synthetic life is not some Halloween Frankensteinian creation of sewed-together body parts hooked up to some lightning rod. With the ability to splice genes together, scientists have developed ways of creating fully fabricated cells, the genetic instructions for which are entirely something from the lab, primitive life forms with attributes that don't exist in nature. The process can create cells or combine the attributes of existing cells, an evil bacteria coupled with a way of living and reproducing through the air, a super bug found nowhere in nature but now a brand new resident of planet Earth. J. Craig Venter is a pioneer scientist who first sequenced the human genome and more recently was the first to create a living cell based on a synthetic genome. Venter has peeked over the horizon and has seen a new world with miraculous implications for medicine, but at the same time, terrifying implications for national security. Lori Garrett is a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of last week's cover piece in Foreign Affairs titled Biology's Brave New World. I asked Lori about scientists doing this work, particularly Craig Venter, Dr. Evil or miracle worker?
I don't think he's either. I think he's an exceptionally good scientist, a brainiac, a master of the biotechnology world, a scientist who's figured out how to have his feet simultaneously in basic research and industrial biotechnology. Every step of the way, he has issued warnings. He has tried to get bioethicists and people in government to pay attention. He's tried to say to everybody, look, we're walking down a really heavy-duty path here, and there's a lot of very possibly negative outcomes that are in the realm of public safety, public health, bioterrorism, and so on, but also in the realm of ethics. Who gets to decide the definition of life and the sort of religious ramifications he understands to be quite profound?
Do you think, and you quote someone in this piece that you wrote for the Council on Foreign Relations, that we've reached the end of Darwinism through the use of these synthetic biology techniques? Do you believe that?
Well, Darwinism will continue out there in nature, but human beings no longer have to await natural selection. And so, yes, we have reached the end of Darwinism in the sense that science is now pushing evolution actively. The limits are really what humanity sets as its own limits, what humanity says, look, we can't go down this path or that path. And unfortunately, so far, that conversation hasn't really occurred, not in an inclusive way, outside of very small circles of scientists.
Where has the national security establishment kind of missed the boat on this technology?
Almost entirely. The problem here is manifold. Most of the rest of government is very far behind the curve. They don't follow the science. They're not on top of it. They don't realize the pace of its movement. Around the world, it gets even more difficult because of the tremendous gaps in understanding as you go into different parts of the world that are further behind the curve on basic science. So the real problem is that if there is any kind of a governance infrastructure designed to protect us from either deliberately released nasty organisms or a greater probability accidentally released that just get out of a lab because of some sloppy mistake somebody made, those infrastructures are weak to begin with, and they are all based on looking for a certain list of known pathogens. So almost every country has on their list of watch out for it, Ebola virus, for example. But the problem is that's so old-fashioned. That's like 25 years ago science. Now we're at the point where you have to have the capacity to anticipate the previously unknown, and perhaps unknowable.
Part of what's really frightening about the national security implications here is just how science kind of knows this story, that the most terrifying technologies are all technologies that have multiple uses, that the research that gives us the miracle breakthrough or miracle understanding also gives us the huge powers of destruction. Is that being played out in biology?
Well, that's the whole point. We've had this game in chemistry with the development of the first agricultural fertilizing chemicals that turned out to also be chemical weapons, and one of those is getting destroyed right now in Syria. Biology had a glimmer of it in 1975-76 with the first forays into genetic engineering and a sort of stop, pause, and think moment that biologists collectively did in what was famously known as the Asilomar Conference. But it turned out that was not really the moment. The moment is now.
I mean, I don't have a whole lot of confidence on the international community developing a cooperative set of protocols to prevent technology from marching forward. It seems that it always does in the end. But are we already at a state where someone could develop the technology and expertise and find the equipment to basically turn a benign cell that lives in my mouth into the most dangerous disease known to humanity?
I don't know if it would be the most dangerous known to humanity, but certainly the technology is all there already. and the experiments in increments have all been done. What hasn't been done, fortunately, yet is somebody really going all out to make, you know, a super horrible microbe. But keep in mind, there's all kinds of beneficial sides to this as well that are driving the technology. People are designing new life forms that can convert sunlight into energy, can devour oil spills, all sorts of things that could be beneficial. And I in no way recommend anything that would slow down the beneficial side of either gain-of-function research or synthetic biology. I think that this is the revolution that biology and medicine have been waiting for, and things you can't even imagine are coming down the pike, and they're coming fast. All I'm saying is, let's make sure that the bad stuff doesn't come down the pike and catch us unprepared and unable to protect humanity, plant life, our livestock, our pets, our environment.
A warning and a lot of cutting-edge science from a journalist, author, Lori Garrett, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations. I want to say thank you, but you've made it a more real Halloween week for me, Lori.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 12 Years a Slave, the true story of a man who overcame more than a decade of injustice to reclaim his freedom. Now playing.
The DIY, do-it-yourself qualities of the new synthetic biology world can be frightening and will challenge the security of nations during this century. But there are other DIY technologies that are equally sobering. Off-the-shelf drones and the design of a handgun that can be constructed completely, downloaded, in fact, to a 3D printer and assembled by hand. 3D printer technology is becoming more and more user-friendly, and the CEO of MakerBot, one of the evangelists for DIY technology, says the democracy of people power and diverse users is the path toward greater innovation, invention, and, he says, safeguards against abuses in this century. It's a trend Bree Pettis says has been building for a long time.
When I was 10 or 11, we got an Apple II Plus, and shortly after there, we got a printer, and it would use this paper that was all connected, and you could use print shop and make banners, and it really changed the way you could get access to technology. And we're seeing that now with manufacturing, whereas manufacturing went away as well. And people didn't have any access to it. And if you wanted to get into it, you pretty much had to be a tycoon. Well, now you can get a MakerBot and you can try things out. And the material's affordable. So if you make something on your MakerBot and it's not quite right, no big deal. You just make another one. And there's some pretty wacky things out there.
Give me a wacky and give me a practical.
So a fan of Doctor Who made a game that is the board is a TARDIS and it unfolds and all the characters are inside and you can't buy this game anywhere.
Give me a kitchen table application of something that is now beginning to be executable from the kind of legal pad sketch straight through to the 3D print.
One of the most exciting things that's happened recently is two ordinary guys, not engineers, one of them lost his fingers and they worked together to make a prosthetic hand for him. And when it worked, they shared the designs and made it so that kids could scale it down or up depending on their size and make their own prosthetic hands. It costs them like $5 in materials. And that's a great example of just two people who wanted to solve a problem. And then when they did, they shared it with everyone. So it solved it for everyone.
Not that prosthetic hands are necessarily the greatest demand product right now, but it certainly makes the point that there needed to be no middle intervention of the medical device industry or the federal government in licensing, that sort of thing. This bypasses a whole level of regulations, and that could be good or bad, but it certainly allows consumers to make decisions on the ground level.
That's one of the core things about the next industrial revolution is that it's powered by ordinary people who just are willing to try things out and get out there and make what they want.
Is open source design better design? Is it noisier design? Is it stranger design? Does it help to have that many cooks making the soup?
The way we thought about like photography, it used to be about the object and the photo. And now it's about looking at it on your screen and sharing it out and your family and friends looking at it.
Photography was an industry and a whole craft that was transformed by user-available technology throughout the 20th century.
So we're seeing that same change with things, which is just phenomenal. I can now email you a thing and you can make it. And it's the exact same as the one that I have.
And when you see that first thing of yours being made, I know you had that experience quite a while ago, but nowadays with the cost of 3D printing coming down, more people are going to have that experience.
You definitely get a kitten watching a goldfish bowl kind of a feeling of like there's this thing in front of you and it's magic. And where there was nothing, your thing just appears in front of you. It feels like something out of Star Trek, but it's real life.
So it's better than Star Trek.
Yeah.
We would call that an upgrade. Bree Pettis, thanks so much.
Great to be here.
Bree Pettis is the founder and CEO of MakerBot. He participated in the 2013 Applied Brilliance Conference here in New York City this month.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. And it's a week to look back at the tragedies and lessons learned from Hurricane Sandy's arrival in the New York, New Jersey area a year ago. The documentary team Retro Report is looking back farther in time, though. The recovery after Sandy relied a lot on wisdom gained from a much worse storm back in August of 2005. Here's Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan.
After Hurricane Sandy hit, I understood the scale and the magnitude and what it would take because of what I had seen in Katrina.
Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, and you can still see that damage from Katrina in New Orleans. Here's former Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco.
We had a housing disaster, a whole big old housing disaster that was untenable. We were operating in the dark. We didn't have anyone who had an instruction book to tell us how to do this.
Are the lessons from Hurricane Katrina an instruction book for Sandy's aftermath and the storms of the future? James Perry is director of the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center. He joins me now. James, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Many years have gone by, but still a lot of lessons still being learned in New Orleans from Katrina, yes?
Sure, and I think perhaps the most difficult one is that recovery is a process that takes a very long time, and I'm not sure that anyone expected that this many years later we would still be working at some of the most basic parts of recovering this community.
Would you say there is something like an instruction book that you can think of that's based on the wisdom of Katrina that would apply to other storms, Sandy, storms of the future, or is it each storm is different?
Well, I do think that there is a bit of a manual or rule book, but the most difficult part about the manual or rule book is the extent to which each set of elected officials and each disaster is willing to follow that manual or that rule book. So, for instance, Chris Christie's staff came to Louisiana, came to New Orleans, came to Mississippi, and talked to every official, talked to every advocate. As a matter of fact, I'm one of the folks who spoke with them, and they got a lot of instructions and a lot of advice. They followed some, they ignored some. And in a similar effect, New Orleans officials traveled to a number of different cities and countries to get advice in our recovery process, and we followed some of that advice, and some of it we didn't follow. So the problem is that if you're building a desk and you have a manual, and the manual says put this screw in position A, and you decide to ignore that that advice, then it's at your own peril.
James Perry, I know you were a part of the Retro Report look back at Katrina. What is the state of housing today, and what are the things that really need to be addressed?
Well, it's a tale of two cities. There are parts of New Orleans that are on high ground, and in those parts, even though they were hit hard by Katrina, when you drive through those communities, you can't tell that there ever was a storm. Those parts of the community are hustling and doing very well. As a matter of fact, perhaps even better than they were before the storm. On the other hand, if you visit the Lower Ninth Ward, a neighborhood that became synonymous with Katrina and famous across the nation because of its devastation, it seems like the storm happened only a few months ago in some parts of that neighborhood because there are areas where, as far as the eye can see, there are vacant lots without houses, without anything. And it just goes on and on and on. But these were neighborhoods.
And, you can see some of those disparities here in the New York, New Jersey area. Some places fully recovered, other places like the Rockaways we'll hear about in just a moment, still dealing with the devastation. Do you have a feeling of solidarity a year after Sandy, knowing what you've been through down in New Orleans?
Certainly more than I would have hoped, in that one of the concerns that I have is that the Christie administration has hired a company called HGI to manage a good deal of their recovery contracting, particularly giving grants to people to rebuild their homes. Well, HGI also managed a part of the recovery process here in Louisiana, and they did not do a good job. And so I'm quite concerned that the difficulties around recovery will be even worse for people in New Jersey as they deal with the same contractor who made terrible mistakes here in Louisiana.
So fingers crossed, but definitely a sense of solidarity as we look back a year after Sandy. We thank Retro Report for introducing us to you, James Perry, and also helping with our look back to the situation in New Orleans after Katrina. James Perry, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
James Perry is director of the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center. In New York City, everyone knows there are five boroughs: Staten Island, Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx. There are also three zones, A, B, and C. Zone A is the mandatory evacuation zone in the case of storm or flood. Zones B and C are more safe. Everyone in New York and New Jersey and up and down Long Island has a new realization of how their identity relates as much to what zone they are in, their proximity and vulnerability to the waters all around us, since Sandy came calling a year ago. But the people of the Rockaways in Queens have always understood their proximity to the ocean. Sandy brought tragic devastation to the vulnerable Rockaways a year ago, a devastation still evident on the streets and in the hearts of residents, including Takeaway senior producer Jen Poyant. Jen explains that for her and for so many residents, a year later, so many are still waiting to get on with their lives.
They're either waiting to get back in their homes still, or they're waiting for money, or they're waiting for their community in general to recover in very specific ways.
And as they wait, the memories of the storm still fresh. Tell me about Steiny Ludford.
So Steiny is a renter in Rockaway, and he lives on the first floor of an apartment, and he spent this storm trying to survive.
I have to secure myself now, so I go to higher ground to stand on some a chair. A little while the water keep rising, and I rise to my feet. I put something again and stand. I get a higher level. It comes above that, and now it goes up to my chest. And when I look through this window, I saw the water, like we're in the middle of the ocean. The whole place was surrounding like that. And I hear the water knocking on the door and banging and people screaming and crying out, help me and all that around me. But there's nothing I could do because I'm trying to survive myself.
Steiny Ludford standing on his furniture in the middle of a house that's in the middle, literally, of the ocean. What's he waiting for today?
He's waiting for one of his closest friends to be able to move back into her home. She's waiting for permits to raise her house. She's also fighting foreclosure. And to see them walk up the steps of her home every week, they just both look exhausted.
Tell me the story of Indiana, who in some ways is the person who is closest to your experience of the storm and closest to you in the neighborhood.
Right. So the neighbor directly across the street from my house is a 74-year-old woman, Indiana Koenig. And she managed to survive the entire storm and the aftermath with no heat for months after the storm.
And here's her experience of Hurricane Sandy.
Could you see the water coming?
Yes, I was on the balcony. The bay was fighting the water like this. And now all I'm saying, Lord, save me. Save me, Lord. Don't let the house go.
And that faith of your neighbor, Indiana, was tested all year long. She eventually lost that house.
She did, but not to Sandy necessarily. We don't know for sure, but she got through the entire winter, no heat. She would cook her bath water on a little gas camping stove out on her front porch. And once the spring came and things warmed up and she didn't have to worry about surviving the winter alone in that house, her house burned down. She has a lot of faith, and I think that's why she has managed to survive. But she's waiting, too. She's waiting to go back home.
The idea of a hardware store in the Rockaways, particularly with so much work being done on so many properties, is the irony in this story. Tell me about Liz Hanna.
Liz has been working in this hardware store that her family owns and founded 40 years ago. Her father founded it for her entire life. And once they got their store up and running again, she had to listen to the stories of person after person, customer after customer. It became a beacon where people could, you know, come get hardware that they needed to start even attempting to repair their homes. Meanwhile, she was trying to repair something that was incredibly dear to her family.
You know, my father passed away 17 years ago, but it's something he put so much blood, sweat, and tears into. And a lot of these fixtures and displays, like, they were all things he built by hand, like all the, but a lot of these were down below the waterline. And, you know, like, I had to throw all them out. And it's just, it's heartbreaking. It was as if somebody died.
What's Liz Hanna waiting for now?
Money. The damages to her business were close to $500,000. She so far got a $25,000 low interest loan from the city, and then two grants, one for $5,000 and one for $10,000. So you're talking a tiny drop in the bucket compared to the losses that she incurred, and she's just not sure this, the business is actually going to survive. This is a business that is a cornerstone of the Rockaway community.
Tell me about Claire and Jeremy Jones, who, you know, their permit story, their paperwork story is maybe one of the most disheartening.
It's so frustrating for them. I don't know how they've managed to do it. After the storm, their house was completely inundated during the storm, and they left for Brooklyn. They've been waiting to essentially knock their house down. They're going to have to raise it, which is a big process for the city right now to encourage people to raise their homes, and they're finding it extremely difficult to make it happen.
And as they go through the process, they're essentially homeless.
To come back and see this neighborhood, I feel like I'm losing touch with this place, and especially with the weather. You know, it's like, oh, it's windy outside, but when I'm home, I know which way the wind's blowing. I know what it is doing to the ocean. I go outside to take the trash out, and I see the moon. Those little things that you start to miss, you know.
It is. It's very, I mean, Brooklyn's fine. You know, it's, everything there is fine. Here is not fine. And I do miss it.
That interview, John, was in December. When I talked to them, they expected to be back in their new home by May. It's taking so long to even just get the demolition permit from the Department of Buildings to even start knocking the house down, much less building, that they're going to have to move back to Brooklyn instead of, you know, spending the year trying to restart their home.
And in the meantime, all of those qualities of the Rockaways, the living on the edge of the ocean, seeing the beauty, the clouds, the breezes, are taken from them. They aren't things that they can enjoy. In some sense, is the story of Sandy for you that beauty of the Rockaways turning on you?
Yes, but there's also such a beauty in seeing neighbors come together. I didn't know Indiana before the storm, and we're close now. We're friends, and we rely on each other as neighbors. And of course, the raw beauty of living by the ocean, yes, it did turn on us temporarily. But I think the question is, how long does it take for that to come back? And then aren't you stronger after for how close we all became in the process?
Are you stronger?
I'm getting stronger. I think I was weaker for a long time for it, too.
Starting tomorrow, you can hear extended interviews that senior producer Jen Poyant and photographer Susanna Ray conducted with residents of the Rockaways, along with accompanying photos in a project featured at the Museum of the City of New York. You can also see them at thetakeaway.org.
Despite all the invitations, you know you could just go out and dance to the rock and roll station. It was all right.
One more thought on technology this hour as we remember Lou Reed, artist, musician, legend who really used technology to fuse pop and culture. You can join the conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Our next guest, you might say, is a renegade rock and roll animal of the United States Senate, Bernie Sanders of the great state of Vermont. And while the White House scrambles to deal with outrage from longtime allies whose private conversations may have been monitored by the high-tech National Security Agency for more than a decade, It seems a bit out of balance, maybe, to be shocked at the U.S. spying on world leaders when, since the Edward Snowden revelations, we know that the U.S. routinely watches over the communications of U.S. citizens, apparently without regard to whether they might do anything to ever threaten the security of the United States. Independent U.S. Senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
How out of balance do you sense this idea that we've been listening to Angela Merkel when the NSA has been listening to perhaps millions of American citizens for just as long?
Well, I think if you take a look at what the NSA is doing today, I think the conclusion that most Americans have reached is these guys are out of control now. They got a whole lot of toys that they're playing with, and I do not believe that they understand the implications of what they're doing. So you got two issues. The first point that you've just made is that they are collecting the phone records of virtually every telephone call made in the United States of America, and they're going a lot further than that right here in our own country. And now, second of all, what we have learned in recent weeks is that they are spying on our allies throughout the world, whether it is Germany, France, Spain, or whatever it is, apparently some 35 countries. And in an increasingly tight global community, where we have got to work together to combat terrorism, to do something about the serious problems facing the global economy, where we must address the crisis, the planetary crisis of global warming, how are we going to have the kind of cooperation that we need when there is massive mistrust now against the United States for this type of spying?
Senator Sanders, I'm wondering what the back down is here. You're certainly someone who advocates, vigorous accountability for the national security establishment. But it seems to me at this point, every nation in the world isn't going to let's regulate this. Their response is going to be, we want these toys, too.
Well, I hope that that is not the answer. I hope that the answer is that we will use our intelligence capabilities to protect the people of the United States and help countries around the world fighting the very serious problems of terrorism. Those are serious problems. But on the other hand, I think what we as American citizens have got to be very loud and clear about is that we need strong legislation, and I hope the administration will join us, to rein in what the NSA and the other intelligence agencies are doing. I was somebody who voted against the original USA Patriot Act, and I voted against the reauthorization. But I do understand that terrorism is a serious issue. There are people who want to do us harm, and we've got to combat that. But you can do that in a way that does not undermine our constitutional rights, and you can do that in a way that shows respect to countries throughout the world. They are our allies. They are our friends. We have common interests. And as Chancellor Merkel pointed out, when you have this type of distrust, it is very hard to work together.
We're talking with the junior senator from Vermont, independent Bernie Sanders. With your view of history, if this is a moment to really rethink the legislative protocols and the ground rules upon which the NSA and the security establishment operates, how would you say this moment differs from the famous Frank Church hearings and reform movement that took place in the 1970s after Watergate?
Well, I think the moment differs in the sense that the technology we now have is far more powerful. This is not a question of where the government is illegally spying on a given individual when they should not be doing that. This is a moment when virtually every telephone call being made in the United States of America, there are records of those calls being kept by the NSA. And we're learning now that they're doing the same in countries throughout the world. So the scope of what they are doing is very, very different. And I think what our position has got to be, I think people who are concerned about civil liberties and constitutional rights has got to be, is that when 99.999% of the American people have nothing to do with terrorism, you do not have to keep records of them. And by the way, John, this is not just a governmental issue. It is a corporate issue as well. It is very frightening, the degree to which private companies now have access to every aspect of our lives. And it is, increasingly difficult to call ourselves a free nation when there are people who know everything about us. So I think this whole issue of privacy, certainly with the government, certainly with the private sector, has got to be raised to a level and start discussing. We need a discussion on this to the degree that we have not had in the past.
Senator Sanders, let me push back on your, if I may say so, left-leaning civil libertarian outlook on this to the extent, let's just say tomorrow we said Bernie Sanders is going to be the person who's the gatekeeper here on the technology and the monitoring. Isn't the nature of the technology that the gatekeeper suddenly becomes the NSA in this particular environment? You can't really have accountability because the person suddenly watching is as powerful as the NSA.
Right. Well, I mean, that is a fair question. And I think the answer is that what we need is kind of new legislation to change the name of the game. And I think what the legislation has got to be about, what some of us are working on right now, is to say, you know, in English, in a non-legal sense, the following. If the government has reason to believe, if a law enforcement agent comes in and says, look, I have reason to believe that Mr. X is involved in terrorist activities, they've got to make their case to an objective board, a FISA court or whatever, make the case. And if they can make the case to a reasonable court, I think all of us would like that agency to go after those people we think are involved in terrorism. But if you cannot make the case, if you have no reason to believe that somebody is involved in terrorism, let's not store those records. And certainly in terms of our relationship with the rest of the world, I mean, just stop and think how we would feel if we were learning that the Germans or the French or the Spanish were tapping the phones of the president of the United States. So what I worry about here is this is really damaging to our relationship with countries throughout the world. As you know, the president of Brazil canceled her trip to the United States. All over Latin America, people are saying, what in God's name is the United States doing? Who do they think they are? Yeah, we may be the most powerful nation on earth, but we're not there to run the whole world. We're not there to dictate to the whole world. And this is doing us, doing our reputation a whole lot of harm.
Well, one thing we can be assured of, because this is public radio, the NSA isn't listening into us, even though our listeners are listening. Bernie Sanders, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bernie Sanders is the junior senator from the state of Vermont. He's an independent. All this hour, we're remembering Lou Reed from the Velvet Underground, who died on Sunday. Elizabeth from Aiken, South Carolina, wrote to us, "Thank you, Lou Reed, for being a part of many perfect days in my life. One example, my wedding day. My husband and I danced to I Found a Reason." Your memories of Lou Reed, tell us your version of the perfect day. Call us at 877-8MYTAKE, send a tweet to @TheTakeaway. And if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.